Item number 11. Oh, I'm sorry. Wrong page.
Wrong day.
Item number 15. Willapa Bay Salmon Management Policy Review. This is a briefing and a public hearing, and I will turn it over to Vice Chair Carpenter to MC.
Chair. Initially, we're going to get a briefing by the staff from the agency. And just so everyone in the room that's prepared for the panel scenario, it looks like we have four people on the rec side. And the rec folks will go first. Tim Hamilton, Melissa Duggan, Francis Azalita, and Ross Barkhurst. Secondly will be the commercial side, which is Lance Gray and Greg McMillan. And lastly will be the conservation group of Jesse Housley and Andy Appleby. Each one of those presenting panels will be 15 minutes each. I know we told you 20, but we have to pare it down a little bit. So the commission can have 15 minutes of dialogue and questions thereafter. So that's the plan. Take it away.
Thank you, Chair Smith, Vice Chair Carpenter, Director Storr, Deputy Director Windrup Commission. Thank you for having us here. My name is Annette Hoffman. I am the Region 6 Fish Program Manager. With me is Chad Herring, the Willapa Bay Biologist. We are here as a follow-up to the December 9th presentation on Willapa Bay, where we identified some issues with implementation of the policy, specifically in 2018. On the January 5th conference call that we had, we clarified or confirmed that we'd be coming back to you in February to report out on the base assumptions that are in the policy and their performance, to request clarification of some of the language on priority that are in the policy to help us implement in 2018, and to share a proposed process subsequent to this meeting. So before we start on that journey, we'd like to start with clarifying some of the information that we presented in December. I'm going to turn this over to Chad to do that.
Chair Smith, Chair Carpenter, Director Storr, Deputy Director Windrup, fellow commissioners, my name is Chad Herring. I'm the Willapa Bay Policy Implementation Biologist. Good morning. So, as Annette so succinctly said just a second ago, we heard significant criticism pertaining to our commission presentation from December 9th that the presentation provided by agency staff didn't clearly state where we were in terms of management and conservation objectives for the 2015 and 2016 reviews. So I would like to take these next three slides really quick to do that right now. So as for Chinook in Willapa Bay, our management objective in 2015 and 2016 was a 20% harvest rate cap to Willapa River and Nacelle River stocks. As you can see, we exceeded that in both 2015 and 2016 by 2 and 4% respectively. Secondarily, we have a escapement goal for natural origin spawners in the aggregate for Willapa Bay of 4,353 fish. For 2017, we have a estimated escapement goal of 2,995 fish. Move on to coho. For coho, our management objective is to make spawning escapement goals. The 2017 number there is in yellow. That is because it is still preliminary. As you may recall from yesterday's presentation on Grays Harbor, similar to Grays Harbor and Willapa Bay, we are still counting coho. We still have reds being constructed as of this week. So this is a preliminary number. It is based off an in-season run update model, and that number is 8,930 fish estimated to date. Some of the recent spawning activity that we've seen, that number is likely to push higher, but not significantly. For chum, because we have not
reached escapement goals 3 out of 5 years. We are constrained to a 10% harvest rate impact on chum stocks. In 2015 and 2016, we did achieve that management objective. And we have a goal for naturally spawning chum in Willapa Bay of 35,400. Where we sit right now for 2017 is just a little over 20,000 naturally spawning chum in the basin, and that number is final.
So the next set of slides will be about the base assumptions that are in the policy. We identified some broad categories, and they capture both some of the technical inputs that went into the modeling, so the number pieces, as well as some of the tasks that we would be able to implement. And so this list, we're going to begin with reporting on some of the performances relative to proper hatchery operations, how have we done relative to broodstock management, and some of the HSRG principles. And then we'll go over to alternative gear and provide some information about what kinds of alternative gears we've been able to implement and how that has worked. There's also some assumptions that we'll be able to do adequate monitoring. So we'll talk a little bit about how we've been able to monitor the commercial fishery, the recreational fishery, and the spawning ground escapement. And then we'll talk about the communications that we've had. And then to wrap up, the last two will be focused on the priority pieces, which is what we'll be asking for later. So I'm going to turn over the next few slides to Chad to talk about that technical performance information.
So first we will start with hatchery operations, and I'd like to start with Chinook. The management objective identified in the policy is that we would be compliant with hatchery reform principles for broodstock management for Chinook by the year 2020. We have a table here of how we are evaluating those metrics. We'll start all the way to the left there in the North Smith system, which it does have a primary population designation for Willapa Bay. There is no hatchery production currently on North Smith, the North Smith system, so we don't have an evaluation of P&I, but we do have a PHAS objective of less than 30%. I have no data there. The reason for that is North River abundances on average over the last 3 years is 191 fish. It's a very difficult system to recover carcasses on, and we have not been very successful in being able to do that. With there being no hatchery production on that system, any PHAS that we may get in that system would just be attributed to straying from the other three hatchery systems in the bay, and likely to be lower than that 30% threshold. We'll move next to the Willapa River system, which is also designated primary, does have hatchery production on that watershed. We have a PHAS objective of less than 30% and a P&I objective of greater than 67%. Willapa River, we haven't done a real good job of hitting either one of those metrics. We have infrastructure issues on the Willapa River system for removal of hatchery fish. There's not a good place to remove those fish, so we see elevated PHASs. And because of that, our P&I metric, we haven't been able to attain that as well.
Excuse me. Sorry. Chad, can you just remind us what P&I is?
P&I is the proportion of natural influence. It really describes how gene flow is working in the basin, whether it is skewed more towards the hatchery environment or is being driven by the natural origin fish. So the higher the number, the more the natural origin fish are driving gene flow in the basin. So hatchery production, as part of the policy, hatchery production in the Willapa River was reduced in 2015, so it is likely that these numbers will come down once we start to see returns of that much lower hatchery production. for the Nacelle River Basin. It is a contributing population. So we have a PHAS metric of less than 30%, same as if a primary system. But the PNI the PNI goal is a little reduced from a primary system. It's at 50%. So we would like to be greater than 50% PNI in the Nacelle system. In the years 2015-2016, we didn't make those objectives. You'll see in 2017 we are estimating that we did make the PHAS objective, but we are still not meeting PNI, and that is primarily due to our lack of being able to include natural origin broodstock in hatchery production.
For those who were around when the policy was developed, I probably should have asked this question long ago, but can we understand why the designations were chosen for each of the hatcheries? Why North is not even performing, but it was selected as a primary, for example?
The population designations are meant to represent kind of your level of threat. Right, extinction level threat, with your primary system being the one that's most likely to contribute to not having negative trends in abundance by taking care of North River system. Willapa Bay on the aggregate could be more healthy by achieving these objectives. Primary is the if I had to quantify them down, primary is our top level. Contributing, secondary, stabilizing, it would be the lowest designation.
Thank you.
Thank you. Now I'll move on to Coho. Identified in the policy was that we would be compliant with HSRG reform principles by 2015 for Coho. Once again, we have a table here of how we're evaluating that metrics and how we've done. For the North Smith system, it is a primary system, once again, for Coho. We have very little hatchery production in the North Smith Basin. There are some RSI and streamside incubation boxes and RFEG projects where we do have small limited releases of coho in the North River system. We do a little bit better job of being able to get carcasses in the North River system just because they're more abundant than Chinook. Our evaluation to date shows that we have met that PHAS objective in all 3 years. Moving on to the North River system, or the Willapa River system, which is also a primary system, we have a hatchery reform objective of a PHAS less than 30% and a PNI objective of greater than 67%. Once again, we have some of the same issues with PHAS for Chinook, for Coho, as we do for Chinook in the Willapa River system. We don't have a really good place to remove hatchery origin fish once they have escaped through the fisheries. So we met that objective in 2016 as well as the PNI objective, but did not make it in 2015 and are not projecting to make it in 2017. The NEMA system is our contributing system for Coho for the Willapa Bay Basin. It has a PHAS objective of 30%. We do not have any hatchery production coming out of the NEMA hatchery for Coho. We have not had extensively monitored indexes for Coho in the NEMA system to date. So we don't have a real good handle on what that PHAS is. With the lack of hatchery production in that system, any PHAS would be basically attributed to, once again, strays from the Willapa system and the Nacelle system, and is thought to be likely less than that 30%. So I'll move on to a little bit more about hatcheries specifically for Chinook, and talk a little bit about weir efficiency. And we have basically two At all three facilities, we do have infrastructure in place to remove hatchery fish that is done in the nacelle system with a removable picket weir. We've made improvements over the last couple of years. Hats off to hatchery staff, specifically John Larson and our area bio staff, Lyle Jennings. They've worked very closely and put in a lot of work. As I referenced earlier with the PHOS that we made in 2017, the work that they have done there is likely to lead us to be able to continue to make significant improvements in PHOS. This won't be a full fix until we upgrade that infrastructure. The nacelle hatchery it was identified in the camp budget for upgrade during phase three, which is scheduled to be completed in 2021-2022 biennia. We will have a fully operating bridge weir along with a redone adult pond sorting and crowding facility, as well as upgrades to the fish ladder. So that's good news. For the NEMA system, as you heard from Ms. Dugan earlier today, we do have a functioning weir. It is very old and requires significant upgrade and upkeep every year to keep in place. Last year, we lost a section of that weir very early on. Has been very problematic, and we're working on a plan to improve that for this year. I know that the NEMA weir has been identified in the WebWorks program as something that needs attention this year before we get to August and these fish start to return. In the Willapa River system, the hatchery is located on Forks Creek, which is a tributary to the main stem Willapa. We do have a barrier dam there on Forks Creek, which does provide for some removal of hatchery fish, but we're really asking the fish to voluntarily take a right. If they don't take that right, they're able to continue on into the upper reaches of the Willapa River. We also have some significant hatchery spawning below the hatchery in the Willapa main stem itself, as well as in Trap Creek and a few other tributaries located nearby to the Forks Creek hatchery. In terms of program adjustments, we've made some reductions in the Forks Creek program. For brood year 2014, released in 2015, we released 3.2 million smolts out of that hatchery. In 2016, we released 350,000. We project to see the transition from that 3.2 million fish to 350K transitioning over the 2019 to 2020 return year. For nacelle, and I apologize, there was a mistake done on this slide. For nacelle, it should be brood year 2015, released in 2016. We released 800K out of the nacelle system, and for brood year 2016, released in 2017, we went to the 2.5 million. So in terms of how that looks for the transition period, we will see the returns off that increase in hatchery production in the 2020 to 2021. So we will have a one-year lag between the reduction at Forks Creek and the increase in nacelle. Now I'll move on a second to talk about alternative gear. The purpose of alternative gear was to target fishery harvest on abundant hatchery stocks, reduce the number of hatchery origin fish in the natural spawning areas, limit mortalities on non-target species and stocks, and provide for commercial fishery opportunities. So for the recreational fishery, in both marine and freshwater areas, those are marked selective fisheries for Chinook. Moving on to the commercial alternative gear, there were some set-asides identified in the policy in years 1 through 4 as targets to reach for the implementation of alternative gear. That has been done 100% through the use of tangle nets to date. Yes.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question on your description of marked selective fishery regulations in marine and freshwater areas. So for Chinook salmon, is it a completely marked selective fishery inside the bar, July, August, September, and all the way through? I've heard something about matching the ocean regulations, which is not always marked selective.
Yes, thank you for that.
For Chinook.
Thank you for that question, Commissioner McIsaac. It's a very good question. When we go to our Willapa Bay 2-1 area rules, we have been marked selective for Chinook over a number of years. Willapa Bay initially opens under Marine Area 2 rules in the past, and depending on the year, specifically for 15 and 16, that has not been a marked selective fishery, and we have had harvest of unmarked Chinook occurring in June and July under those Marine Area 2 regulations. Welcome. So just to go into the table here real briefly, we've got some set-asides that were identified in the policy, 1% in the first year, ramping up slowly as we move through. You can see through the table we have been able to implement that for the Willapa River stock and have achieved those objectives. It's been a little bit more problematic in the nacelle. In the Nacelle River, we did meet that in 2016. 2015 and 2017, where we had planned to meet this objective, we really had run sizes that were much lower than what were forecasted going into the season. So another aspect of alternative gear for commercial fisheries was the development of other alternative gear types. We initiated a process in 2016 and 2017 to try and develop some of these other gears. We heard recommendations or proposals from the commercial fishing industry around reef nets, purse seines, a floating pontoon fish trap, and many others. We have been unsuccessful in getting any of those gear types across the finish line in terms of testing to see if they were successful. We started that process in 2017 around the pontoon fish trap. It was suspended later in the season. Partially, we had some permitting hurdles that were difficult, and also tremendous public feedback when we reached out to those stakeholder meetings. Really, we had a lot of opposition to moving forward in this, both in terms of the process that was used as well as the logistics of the trap itself.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the lowest row there of 2017, just so I understand that row, the alternative gear goal, that would be a 6% harvest rate impact as the goal?
Yes, that would be correct.
And so for the Willapa River and the Nacelle River, it was 8.4% and 4.7% for a total of, looks like 13% or so. Anyway, more than double. So when we talk about going over by 21%, 13 percentage points of that 20% was by this tangle net fishery?
That's a good question. Thank you, Commissioner Isaac, for that. McIsaac, the 6% is for each Willapa River and Nacelle River together, not in the aggregate. They're each evaluated just towards Willapa River stock and towards Nacelle stock. So it's a 6% set aside for Willapa River and a 6% set aside for Nacelle River of the 20% harvest rate impact cap. I'm not sure I did a very good job explaining that.
Let me try. The 8.4 and the 4.7 are not additive, and they're not relative to that 20% cap. The 20% cap is on each of these stocks, Willapa River and the Nacelle River, independently. So 8.4% of the impacts in the Willapa River of the 20% were taken by alternative tangle net gear. And the same with the Nacelle River, except it was 4.7.
Thanks, Matt.
Now I'd like to talk a little bit about our monitoring programs. I'll start with the commercial fishery. In the commercial fishery, we have a goal of sampling 20% of the landed catch that is done in conjunction with the fish buyer at those warehouses. We also have an onboard observation observation program, and we shoot for a target of 15% of the total effort of those commercial vessels. Both of these sampling programs combined together allow us to have some in-season fishery management actions based on actual harvest to date. And they also provide us with some catch per unit effort information of the commercial fishery that we can utilize for in-season updates in terms of coho run size. And both of these programs allow us to further continue to develop and refine management tools and models that are used for in-season management. For the recreational fishery, in-season monitoring of recreational fishery provides CPUE and counter ratios and stock composition data. The harvest data is from CRC and is not generally final till 2 years later. So this does not allow us to manage in-season based on catch estimation. The policy assumed that we would have a 3.2 impact to natural origin Willapa Bay Chinook in the aggregate with room to grow. Data that we've collected to date through these programs has shown us that the recreational sector can achieve a 14.9% impact to natural origin Willapa River Chinook stocks alone. These programs do allow us to continue to refine and develop technical and management tools to be used in season.
Chris was asked the other day, but so we do know creel surveys?
We do have some recreational monitoring that takes place at Tokeland and South Bend. It is not a robust enough monitoring program to provide us with catch estimation to date.
Okay. Is that a resource issue, just lack of resources to?
Yes, it was a lack of resource issue, yes. For spawning ground surveys conducted in Willapa Bay, for coho and chum, these spawning ground programs provide us with the ability to update run sizes in season. The Chinook run size update is under development. Don't know how that's going to work out, but we are working on a tool for that moving forward. These programs provide us with postseason adult abundance estimation as well as age composition and origin composition for the spawning population. Now, lastly, I'd like to talk about the communication for just a second. Pre-season, we have multiple stakeholder and public meetings as part of the forecast meeting, as part of the North of Falcon pre-season salmon planning process. They include a forecast meeting, meetings with the advisory group, as well as the public. The advisory group's role is to advise us on the shape and scope of fishery packages for the upcoming season. We also have an Administrative Procedures Act process, a rulemaking process after our proposed regulations are filed in the form of a CR 102 document. There is about a month of public comment that is taken on those proposed regulations, culminated with a public hearing that has been held in Montesano before the 103 is filed in order to finalize those regulations. In season, we have been working on developing some weekly summaries that we send out to our interested parties distribution list, typically August through September. Traditionally, that has been focused around commercial harvest. In the last few years, we have added to that document in terms of hatchery escapement, basically where we are to date versus what we've seen in the past, and some recreational monitoring information. Commercial harvest and the recreational monitoring information is also been added to a web page where people can see that in as close as to real time as we can get it. Usually there's about a week or so lag before we can get that updated on the website. And hatchery escapement data is available through the hatchery escapements report available online. And we have had communications with our advisory group on the shape and scope of fisheries when it looks like management actions may need to be warranted. For postseason, we have an annual review that we've done typically in February to brief the commission as well as the public on how the preceding year shaped up and whether we hit those targets or not. So, with that, I'll turn it back to Annette. Thank you.
So the last two base assumptions, the first one is or focus on the allocation of Chinook. And, of course, this is the allocation of harvestable, or not harvestable, but the allocation of impacts. So, of course, the primary objective for Chinook is to meet our spawning escapement. After that, the impacts in the policy languages as we have been implementing them are to allocate those to the recreational, to a full and enhanced recreational fishery, which was assumed to be at the 3.2%, but with room to grow. After that, impacts are allocated to meet the alternative gear set-asides that we saw on a previous slide. And the language in the policy then has leftover impacts available to the commercial gillnet fleet. So what I don't have are slides on coho and chum, but there's a little bit in reverse order, meeting the spawner objectives, and then allocation to commercial fisheries, and then after that, commercial allocation to recreational. So this, how has this worked out over the last couple of years? The dark line there is essentially 100% of what these base assumptions. So these base assumptions went into a model, and the model predicted an outcome or made a projection. The black line is sort of 100% for each of these categories. So on the left-hand side are the catch numbers, so numbers of coho, numbers of Chinook, and total salmon caught by the recreational fleet in 2015 and 2016. On the right-hand side are the ex-vessel values for that come from Chinook and coho, and then total. And you'll notice that that Chinook and coho don't exactly add up to total because there are some other, you know, there's chum in there as well. But those are the performances of that metric in 2015, 16, and 17. So before we get to our question, I just wanted to remind us and everyone that these fish do mix. It's a mixed stock fishery out in the bay where the marine, recreational, and the commercial fisheries operate. And so if there is if there's a target on one species, there is an expectation that that prosecution of that target will impact other species.
Chairman, the question has to do with the two coho run timings. So you have an orange that's the hatchery coho, and you have a green that's wild coho. Is this difference in timing due to genetic divergence from the hatchery stock? Or what, I would have presumed that the run timings would be identical if the wild stock was the source for the hatchery, and there hadn't been any selective breeding to change that. So why are these two, why is the hatchery run of coho so much earlier than the wild run of coho?
So thank you for that question, Commissioner McIsaac. We manage Willapa Bay on the aggregate for coho, but we do have two separate timed coho runs through the bay. We have a normal timed or an early timed run that is predominantly made up of hatchery coho, and we have a late timed coho run that is predominantly made up of wild fish. It's not necessarily that that we're only making early timed hatchery coho. We do have hatchery production programs that have a normal timed and a late time component. The early timed or normal time is a much bigger program size than the other, and they do overlap significantly. So
maybe it might be better to interpret this as you have two different strains of coho in the basin, an early run that has mostly hatchery but some wild, and a later run that's mostly wild with some hatchery fish.
Exactly.
Commissioner Baker?
You mentioned somewhere in the presentation that the early Chinook harvest is, once they cross into the bay, we are still working under marine rules, which allows the catch of unmarked fish. I don't understand. Why do we do that?
I'll do my best here to answer that. Under the marine rules, in the early time of the summer, there is an expectation that a good portion of those fish are dip-ins from stocks that are passing Willapa on their way to the Columbia River. And I mean, back in the 2015, I'm looking at Chad just for confirmation that there was considered to be enough. I mean, back then we assumed a 3.2% impact rate, so on the Willapa River or Willapa Bay stocks, and there wasn't, from what I can tell, a need for any adjustments.
Well, that was a good question, Commissioner Baker. I'd like to just follow up on it for a second on Annette's comment. CRC data from 2010 to 2014, that level of unmarked harvest was really minuscule. And most years it was next to nothing. I think one year there was 2 fish harvested, another year there were 8 fish harvested. What we've seen really in 2015 and 2016 is an increase in the number of people who are coming, increase in effort during that earlier time frame, coming to Willapa Bay, and correspondingly that harvest has also increased.
One more. So on the blue graph here, which is the Chinook salmon, is this run timing across the bar? And I'll put this in the context of a question from Commissioner Baker. So if this was across the bar, it looks like the fish just start coming into the Willapa Bay on August 5th to the 9th, and the meat of the run doesn't come across until September. If this is not the across the bar, but this is up at the hatchery or somewhere up in the streams, then when do these fish come across the bar, and is this June and July fishery really when the fish are milling in the bay and waiting to come in the river?
Oh, once again, thank you for the question, Commissioner McIsaac. I think I should point out that this graph is not an actual run timing graph of fish moving into the bay. It is based on commercial catch, as a pseudonym, basically, for run timing through the bay, and was done for that 13-year time period, 1990 to 2003. Really, that earlier time frame that you're seeing there for Chinook, commercial fisheries didn't really take place too much earlier than that. So we don't have a real good handle on exactly when everything's moving in. We can make some assumptions based on the CRC data that we have to date. As I referenced earlier, catch was really limited for natural origin fish in that early time frame, although you see significant contribution of hatchery Chinook in that fishery. This is where we need some more understanding of exactly what and when and how fish are moving into Willapa Bay across that bar.
Commissioner
And you've mentioned that the last 2 years is when the 20% was exceeded, but it was the last 2 years when there was a lot of effort fishing in the bay during this ocean time frame, I'll call it for the moment. Is all of that catch counted as Willapa fish when you calculate your 21% and 22%, or do you call out fish that you don't believe are Willapa fish?
Once again, thank you for the question, Commissioner McIsaac. Yes and no. The harvest, we make an estimate based on CWT and genetic data that we've collected to date about the composition of that harvest, both in terms of hatchery origin and natural origin fish. Done some substantial work with John Kerry and some of the FRAM modelers to get a handle on exactly how we should partition this stock composition out. Basically, in the August time frame, in that north area or commercial catch area 2T, where the majority of the wreck fishery is prosecuted, it's thought that 58% genetic data, as well as a study that our WDFW staff conducted in 2008, Mr. Kassler, would suggest that stock composition in that August time frame is 58% Willapa origin stock, 42% non-local. We didn't have a whole lot of data to look at for the June and July time frame. We dug into CWTs and what we did have for genetics, and we are estimating now that of those encounters, either for natural origin encounters in the June and July time step, that 29% of those would be Willapa origin, with correspondingly 71% being non-local. So those catches were partitioned based on those metrics that I just mentioned and are included in the 20% calculation, i.e. the 22 or 24. So there are some Willapa fish that make up that overage in that fishery.
You say there are some Willapa fish. So when you said they're partitioned, did you mean they've been subtracted out? So the 21% is a genuine Willapa problem, a Willapa fish with no other outside fish in it?
No. So for 2016, for example, we had 153 unmarked fish that were harvested in the June-July time step. What we've done is 29% of those would be Willapa origin and are included in the evaluation of the 20%. So those fish are included in the, I think it was 24.1% is what we ended up for Willapa River stock. So once we get a number, an estimate of those impacts that are Willapa origin, then we also use genetic data to tell us the probability that it was a Willapa River fish or a Nacelle River fish.
So that brings us to our question of whether or not, you know, our application of the policy has met the commission's intent. And before we just pause on that, we had one public meeting a couple of weeks ago where we brought some questions to the public about not just this question of priority and that, but also some broader questions of where are we, where are some of the issues in the policy that we might need to address over the coming year. But one of the questions that we tried to focus on was to get some input on what their thoughts were on the priority. And what we heard was that there are some opinions that are still quite far apart from there should be no priorities in there to the priorities are fine, they just need to be implemented as they've been identified. And if we do that, then there will be no, or there's a real possibility that there would be no Willapa River impacts available for the Gillnet fishery in 2018. So what we've done is we do have, we did post all of those comments that we heard on our website for, and this is not meant to be a comprehensive list or a summary. It was just more of a, just giving you an idea of some of the things that we heard during that meeting. We intend to engage in a process over the next year to work on some of these issues, identify, work with stakeholders on some of these base assumptions. Are we interpreting them correctly? Are we using the right metrics? That are there some key conflicts in the policy that we might not be focusing enough attention on? And in when we move from phase one to phase two, there is a comprehensive policy review that we will be bringing to the commission, and we believe that there should be significant stakeholder engagement in that as well. So, so that I think brings us back to this question about the intent of the priority language in the policy and how we should be interpreting that and applying that.
Let me say thanks to Ms. Hoffman and Mr. Herring for all the work since December on this and coming into town early for the Fish Committee meeting and all the work that you've done on this. A question on slide 15 before we go to public testimony and the panels. You had mentioned that when the policy was developed, that the recreational fishery was at about 3.2%. And alternative gear at that point in time, I assume, was zero.
Correct.
And I wondered, what was the commercial gillnet gear impact rate for the same period of time that the average of 3.2 came up for the sport fishery? On Chinook.
That's a good question, Commissioner McIsaac. I don't have that number with me right at this point in time. I can get that for you very quickly.
And then if you can imagine another imaginary column here that is currently. And so you mentioned that now the sport fishery can take about 14.9% or can take it or has been or something like that. The alternative gear set aside in the policy is 6. And what has been the commercial gillnet gear take harvest rate in the past couple of years that might go along with this 14.9 as a couple year average?
Oh, I don't. But it would be like the 24% minus the 14.9.
Yeah. It's been about, off the top of my head, thank you for the question, Commissioner McIsaac. I want to say it was planned at right around 11% or so. It really depends on, there's a differential harvest based on how the recreational fishery occurs, primarily in the north end. They have a much bigger swing at Willapa River stock than they do nacelle stock. So it's really depending on which stock you're talking about. If it's Willapa River stock, that number's been pretty low. For Nacelle River stock, it's been a little bigger because the wrecks don't impact that Nacelle River stock at the same rate.
So you had a slide earlier that had the two rivers. Let's see, that would be slide 10, I guess. So is that 8.4 and 4.7 something that would correspond to a traditional gillnet fishery, or does that have alternative gear in it, or what?
The 8.4 is the entirety of the alternative gear impact to that stock. So of the, I believe we said in 2015, Willapa River stock was a 22.1% impact. 2.5 of that 21 came from the use of tangle net gear in the commercial fishery.
Okay. just trying to, you've used the word pickle before, and just trying to get the pickle. So 14.9% plus a 6% set aside plus some traditional gillnet fishing, if that's even in the mix, puts the boundary around the pickle, I guess.
We can bring you those numbers within the next 10 minutes.
I just want to, before we go to the panels, I just want to go back and reflect on the effort that was brought forward by the commission at the time on this policy. There were dozens of meetings, more than that, hundreds of hours devoted to this, an untold amount of public comment and staff time put into this. And now I sit here and I kind of get the sense that you want us to come down and manage the damn fishery. That's the feeling I get. You know what the policy says. We're sitting up here saying we can probably make some adjustments and tweak it, but when I was gainfully employed and had a bunch of employees, the one thing I didn't want them to do is come to me and always give me reasons why things don't get done, can't get done. Come to me with solutions on how to make things work. So I'll shut up now, but that's the feeling I get, and it bothers me a great deal. So,
all right. No, let's go to
that. I think Ron wants to say something. Yeah. Hi, Ron.
Chair Smith, Commissioner Carpenter, thanks for the comments, I think. All of you know Willapa, like many fisheries, is difficult. And I want to make sure that we are clear to the commissioners on what we're asking. And I'm not sure that by the words in the slides or the words spoken that we're in explicit in what we're asking of the commission. Many times, because of the words in the policy, it's difficult to have two sectors who are passionate about what they do and or are a part of their income and livelihoods to see flexibility in what's going on when something's new and ever-changing. That makes our job very difficult because of that friction that might be in the meeting. What we're here today to ask is that as the commercial catch run timing slide showed, there's overlap in what's happening with Chinook and Coho. That happens everywhere. In every single fishery that I'm aware of. And on the January 5th conference call, we had a conversation about, or you had a conversation about, the appropriateness of the utilization of Chinook and the priority for the recreational fishery. And I am not sitting in front of you asking you to change that. Neither are staff. But I think it would be nice to have that conversation or to remind ourselves that does not mean that the recreational fishery takes every Chinook available to then turn off the commercial fishery. And there are some people that believe that the Chinook have to, a certain number of Chinook impacts have to be saved to allow a prosecution of the Coho fishery, to allow this policy, from my recollection of its construction and the intent of the commission, to perform properly. So what we are asking is there a way that the commission, after listening to panels, could have a conversation about what that might look like, if that is an appropriate statement, so that we have some ammunition to temper crowds, to direct people, instead of trying to say that without it being written, nor is it explicit in the adaptive management portion of the policy. we all believe we have the flexibility to do what I just said. And I don't want to go push if that's not the intent of the commission. And so my apologies if we did not have clarity in presentation or the explanation of that, but I think that describes what we're here to try to receive from the commission.
I appreciate that explanation, Ron, and I hope you understand my comments. I go back to when we were in meetings to the extreme. Jim Scott, I could go on and name a bunch of others, and I mean best foot was put forward to come up with something that's workable. From where I sit, that's still the intent. So,
Commissioner Grable.
I want to thank staff again for their ability to provide excellent information. But I do want to go back. What I asked Kelly Cunningham, or I asked the room, and Kelly was kind enough to make a note after our first briefing on Willapa. What can we do within the parameters of the current policy, given the adaptive management capabilities and other tools available to us, that can fix the problems that we see? The intent is not to eliminate the commercial fishery, as Ron has mentioned, but we do need to have better control of the recreational fisheries. And what I asked at that time is, and what I expected to see today, was recommendations from staff on how we can fix the problems that you've described to us for, I think, the third time. I haven't seen any recommendations of how we can move forward within the parameters of the policy. And if it's not possible within the parameters of the policy, then what do we need to change? That's what I've been waiting to review.
Don has a question. Did you have?
Yes, I'd just like to say something. So I thank you again for the presentation. And Commissioner Carpenter, I really understand, I think, and it's been repeated, and I sort of came in on the tail end of the presentation of the final document, but understand the effort and respect tremendously the effort that went into putting this together. I also think that I understand what the staff is bringing to us, and thank you, Ron, for sort of clarifying, it is to get a sense of some things that I think are not completely clear in terms of the words in the policy, and also recognizing that when we put these policies together, there are assumptions made. As is pointed out, some of the base assumptions were not meeting the timelines. The impacts, the estimate of recreational impacts turned out to be much higher in year one even. So with those assumptions not being fully met, and some lack of clarity in words, and I'm thinking in particular enhanced recreational priority, as well as the expectation that recreational effort would increase. And so how does that mesh with retaining a commercial fishery? What I hear being asked is how does the commission feel about the interpretation of enhanced recreational priority, and how that meshes with retaining a commercial fishery, and just kind of getting that guidance. So I think that it's not, they're not asking us specifically for how to manage it, but what is
our guidance on this. And certainly my guidance, and I think some of us have said it, is that there is no expectation that the commercial fishery is to be eliminated as we move forward with an enhanced recreational priority, that given the changes year by year and the number of fish and everything, that adaptive management means that there will be adaptation enough to ensure that both fisheries are retained to some extent. I hope I'm clear on that.
And we'll take, Joe, you can we'll have one last question before we break into the panels.
Yeah, I want to say just a couple of things. And I think people have covered these between the commissioners and Ron's statement, but you know, this is a complex and competitive fishery. We've had a policy in place for some time. I mean, I think we're able and willing to manage against that policy. But we're learning that there are different interpretations of some of the policy statements there. We're also learning that some of the assumptions that were made when the policy was put in place may not still stand or may need to be adjusted. And so what we're looking for, and hopefully at some point in writing, just so we can remember it 6 months from now or 2 years from now, is a sense from the commission that we are indeed interpreting these policies appropriately, or that the commission understands where we're seeing assumptions that may or may not still apply. And so, you know, just taking a look at what we have, what we've done in terms of managing against the policy and making sure everybody's on the same page, that there's clarity about what the mission is here.
Well said. One last question, then we'll get into the panels.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just as a last matter here, and I agree with Commissioner Thorburn on many things there. A lot of work's been done on this. It's difficult to get the policy language perfect, and I think it's entirely appropriate for the staff to ask for policy guidance when there's confusion in place. You know, we don't want the staff to be out there making policy. Policy decision-making is on our shoulders here at this front table. And while I would agree with my colleague, Commissioner Carpenter, that the commission should not be down managing the fishery, we've got some talented professionals who can do a great job at that. But the commission should be making the policy decisions. And so after the panels and after public testimony, I think it's appropriate that we provide some guidance and not expect the staff to have to do our job. We don't want to do their job.
Chair Smith, thank you. And I just wanted to share my appreciation to the commissioners for the accolades for staff. They're very hardworking. We've also got a room full of folks here that have stuck with us regardless if they believe in us or not. And I appreciate all of them. I worked with them directly for 10 years. I have a great deal of respect for them, and I'm glad we're going to hear from different panels of those sectors today. I look forward to hearing what they have to say. Thank you.
And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Vice Chair Carpenter to
thank you guys very much.
Bring the panels up.
Okay, the first one is the red group. That's Kim Appleton, Melissa Duggan, Brett Zalita, and Ross Barker. You folks will have 15 minutes. And the next one will be the, after them will be the commercial, Lance Curry, Greg McMillan, and our friend who's here, Bob Lake. Is that your
grand?
Is that
what?
Oh, okay.
Before we start, any chance anyone in this room has a laser pointer?
I do. Right here.
Oh, Marlisa.
You're so prepared.
Switch over here.
Oh, yeah.
So to reiterate, my colleague Carpenter,
make sure it's
15
still
minutes.
Oh.
All right. You can do it.
I'm at the end.
Okay. We'll get started. I'm Ross Barkhurst. Save time by letting each person introduce themselves as they go. I've owned land on Willapa Bay for 40 years, fished and hunted there full-time since retiring early in 2002. All four of us here were involved from start to finish in the commenting and creation on what was called the ad hoc committee for this policy. We're very familiar with it. We saw the need to be here today because for 3 years in a row, your annual reports just didn't tell you what was going on with this policy in this bay. I suspect that's why you got a rerun and resubmit today, and that you asked for it, and it was an improvement. Still, I count 12 items where the policy is in noncompliance for the last 3 years, and maybe one or two of them are addressed to you. Okay, that's a problem. The main objective of this policy is to avoid ESA. This is the fourth presentation in a row that nobody's told you. How are we doing? The feds have smoke alarms when you're getting close, and then they have ESA. Nobody's ever told you four times. How are we doing against those numbers? Big problem. That's why we have a policy. I'm going to talk about habitat. You're going to get a 3-H discussion today. Eelgrass inventory. There's been chemicals in the bay for most of the last 15 years, one now by permit that impacts eelgrass. There has not been an inventory of eelgrass in the bay wide since 2006. We really need one. If and when we get wild fish coming back down into the estuary, they need to have a habitat. They have no handle on how much of it is left. The herring spawning mass, we talked about that in 2016. We had the impression there was going to be a herring spawning mass survey for the first time last year in 10 years. There is no report on that survey. I'm told by the people that would have, could have, should have done it, they didn't find any. It's not clear whether they ever left the dock or not. There's no report. That's the problem. I would hope you would look into it. Third is burrowing shrimp removal. We talked about that the last time. Since then, we have the resolution of all the comments by the Department of Ecology. There are over 8,000 comments. Extensive comments from NOAA and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, including the comment, and they both vigorously opposed chemical removal of burrowing shrimp. They stated that the state doesn't have a take permit on green sturgeon. It's critical habitat. You don't take their food without taking sturgeon, so why do you even think you can do this? Okay. And as we said before, not one comment from WFW. That's a problem. I'm going to turn this over to Tim.
How many minutes? Three? Four?
Three.
Okay.
Tim Hamilton, Twin Rivers Fish and Wildlife Advocacy. I've been involved in this thing from the get-go, and I want to tell you a little quick history. It was a chum bay, okay, it had some coho, didn't have much Chinook there, because it's not got Chinook rivers, okay? So we come along and we switch over hatchery production and crank out a large amount of Chinook, okay, primarily for the ocean pools. 92% of them are gone before they cross the bar. And as we did that, and we walked through that with a draft policy, with a maximum harvest rate of 30%, we were receiving harvest rates of 50 and 60%. And we also saw our runs declining like a bat out of heck. Still doing so. And when we passed this policy, we warned this commission and argued with this department that we have not hit the bottom. We haven't seen the bottom, okay? We're going to go through even worse. So we developed a two-phase program and a compromise to let the nets get onto the remaining hatchery fish that we've brought down, bringing those numbers down, okay? Mainly in the north, where the wrecks fish. So what you'll notice happen is 90% of their hatchery fish are going away in a year. So where did they fish at? The department comes in here with an agenda. They do not come in here as non-biased staff, like I'm used to in the legislatures, to make sure that you can all make knowledgeable decisions. They have an agenda. I can tell you what they want coming out of Raymond today. I'll write it down for you if you want. We've known for 2 years. Okay, they've asked us about these impacts with the wreck. The wreck community has said, you want us to hang up our poles, we'll do it. If you let those fish go to the gravel, where we're not meeting escapement goals on anything. And they said, no.
nets or nothing. Okay? Now, who got the impacts? The impression of all this I would have if I was a layman was that those silly racks dramatically increased their production or catch. And as a result, the nets got knocked out. Guess who gets most of the impacts for Chinook? The nets. Okay? You're looking at selective fishing with poles where the wrecks got 7,786 fish by killing 221 in 2016. In the meantime, killing 298, 70 more, the wrecks, the nets only got 3,315. That's because they're not as efficient. So now we come back and say, all right, let's take these guys who are fishing selectively, getting on those hatchery fish so they don't stray into the gravel, and take their impacts and give them to a non-selective fisheries. Now, if you want to help the gill hunters out, ask yourself, what this department wants is to take those impacts and wrecks, and then they want to turn around and change the harvest rates so we never ever get to escapement goals, and we never ever avoid ESA. That's what's coming at you. You ask yourself, if you give them the wink and a nod they want, and what's that? Give us a nod, remember that? You have a written document, a policy. It's on the website. They get handed out to people in the meeting, and they'll go in and watch the department do this and say, well, this isn't what it says on this policy, but we have the nod. This is what the commission told us to do. You're going to be set up as the fall guy. Okay? So, one more time. All we have to do to make this thing work is follow the words of the policy. They're clear and precise. In fact, they wrote them. Now, for the college-educated people to come back and say they're confused about the common English language, what about you shall not exceed 20% that they need clarification on? They don't. They want your nod to ignore the policy again.
Thank you, Jim. Commissioners, thank you for an opportunity to speak today. There's no way I can take 4 minutes and condense it down to three, but I'm going to give it my best shot. So I'm going to talk about the intent of the policy. Clearly, when we built this policy, we intended to bring change. We were not meeting conservation or HSRG objectives, and we were headed for ESA listing considerations on Chinook and Chum. We placed the highest priority on rebuilding natural origin Chinook and Chum stocks to the gravel while meeting HSRG requirements. A priority for Chinook harvest was given to the selective wreck fishing community, and this priority intended to allow the wreck fishers a full bag limit unhindered by early July and August commercial exploitation, as was the protocol for the previous 50 years. This policy allows for the growing wreck fishing community to develop a sustainable and economically beneficially selective Chinook fishery in freshwater and the bay. The only people who ever really thought we only had a 3.2% impact rate were the department on paper. We always knew that we had the capacity to consume more if we were given an opportunity to fish on a bay that actually had fish in it, which never happened prior to 2015, and which was clearly demonstrated by our impact rates that you saw in 2015. I want to talk a minute today in at length about in-season management. To me, it seems like that terminology is self-explanatory. What does it mean, and what was it meant to accomplish? This tool is designed to use common sense combined with information from NOAA, pre-intercept harvest data from Alaska South to our local terminal catch, to make adjustments to in-season harvest allocations when they're needed. This tool is to help stop over-harvesting our NORs and should be used in a fluid motion, decreasing commercial or recreational harvest to avoid troubled salmon stocks, increasing selective opportunity to remove surplus hatchery stocks for both when possible. This is not rocket science, nor are these data sources anecdotal, as often used by the department as an excuse not to implement them when needed. Yet Region 6 refuses to use this tool to salvage escapement at the last minute and to salvage conservation objectives, unless it is to benefit the commercial harvest allocation. In my opinion, and years of data supports the notion that a a preset season allowed to run on autopilot without in-season adjustments and considerations is bad policy, and this bad policy is implemented every year. Every successful business takes responsibility for poor marketing and poor performance. Who is responsible here? Is it past directors? Is it Ron Warren? Is it the entire department? Well, it's not me. WDFW needs help changing the performance, personnel, and perceptions. I want to assist Region 6 in managing for success in our future. I stand behind the new policy. I helped craft it. I know what its intent is. I know the policy is an excellent foundation for success if implementation is done as it was intended. If a payback for over-harvest is enforced on commercial harvesters, they will self-regulate and simply stop doing it. There's never been an incentive for them to stop before. Hand in hand with the department, they go over every year. They have never once met their harvest objective. Give recovery a chance and support this policy as it was intended. In closing and seeking guidance, in 2018, I request a special panel of five citizens to review all in-season management requests for Willapa. I think this would be a good step forward. Run representative from each should include conservation, commercial, freshwater, and marine recreation, and a representative from WDFW. Results and requests should be presented to the commission and the director in real time and shared with the public to create transparency. Thank you very much.
Should be a familiar face, Francis S. DeLila, Willapa Bay advisor. From the outset, I've been in this process through a couple of policy renditions, one that actually never made it to policy level, but since about 2005. I'm going to go back through my presentation. Where's the actual first slide? Just trying to help. Okay. So staff is asking you for clarity, for interpretation, for guidance. It's there in the black and white. Where's it? Whoop. There it is. Conservation and restoration. That's why we're doing it. That's why we're doing it. The restoration piece, we're told by our scientists, and some of the conservation people will be here to testify to this as well, the harvest rate that we need to achieve the baseline escapement goal for wild Chinook in 16 to 21 years is 14%. We need to harvest at a rate of 14% or less on Chinook, and we might make it in 16 to 21 years. Every other rate of harvest resulted in failure to ever meet the goal. I mean, there was one in there. I think if we went down to 20%, we might get it in 25 plus years. But we chose the 14 because that's what would get us there in a not so painful time frame. But even that was rejected. Our commercial folks didn't like that. We had hatchery fish still sitting out there, and so we compromised at 20%. So that's the goal. The impact rate on Willapa Nacelle natural origin is 20%. There's your metric. That's clear as day. You got to do it. We haven't done it. How are we doing? Here we are, 22.4, 24.2. Mean over the 2 years that we have actual run size reconstruction, 23.1. Staff makes you feel like, well, we're over by 1% or 2%. Each 1% or 2% is 5% because the denominator is 20, okay? So this is for Willapa. And I've got this 14.9 here. Everyone's making a big deal about this 14.9 of why is that 14.9, you know? That's what we're capable of doing. We were given a sport priority for Chinook. And so it shouldn't be unexpected that if we have the priority, we would consume most of the impacts for that stock.
And that's just one river.
That's just one river. So let's look at the other, Nacelle. How are we doing? We're going over. But where's it happening? No one's talking about this 16.6 number. This is what the commercials do with the Nacelle fish. And that's appropriate, too. If this number were correct, the proportions of commercial to sport here, that would be okay. But let's get this number down to 20 or less. And then this mix of 4 to 1 3-1, 4-1 would be okay. That's a commercial priority on nacelle stock. That's the impact you have available to fuel your coho and chum fishery in the south of the bay.
Francis, we've got 1 minute.
Oh, I got 1 minute. Okay, I'm sorry. Oh, my gosh. Make it accountable. We're just asking for accountability. Okay, the purpose of the accountability is to maintain this rebuilding trajectory. Commissioner McIsaac asked, where is that payback? It's right here. Here's your policy. The reason we do it is so we can maintain the 16 to 21 years. If we don't keep ourselves accountable, that just gets stretched out 25, 40, 50 years. When is it? It's never going to happen. Horrible slide. This is the stuff we deal with in the planning. That's the planning law. That's one page, one tab out of a 13-tab document. Here it is for 16. The part I want you to see lives down here, so I've magnified it here. Here's how you get your payback. And please give me a little time to do this. The number you want to look at, is right here. We're going to run out. It's 192. Bottom of that, under the orange, you'll see 20%. That's the targeted for Willapaw stock. The other 18.8, that's what we planned in 2015. The 0.192 is 19.2% on the aggregate. That's the base in your policy by which you're going to judge this payback. It asked that we base this on the percentage by which the postseason estimate exceeded the preseason expectation on the aggregate. So here it is.
We got to wrap it up.
I will. I'll wrap it up. So how are we doing? This is the overage year by year. This is what we planned on. This is what we actually did. We're over by 15.6%. We're over by 9.7%, nearly 10%. On aggregate, we're over by 12%. If you did a compounding of the overage for each year, you need to pay back 2 years. 0.15 and the 0.09, compound that out, 26.8% is what I calculate. Okay? That's what we pay back. We're over by 26.8. Let's reduce it by 26.8. So by that formula, you're going to take your 20% and you should prosecute a harvest rate in 2018 of no more than 14.6.
Okay,
that's what we're asking for.
Can you provide your information here to Tammy?
Tammy's got it. She's okay. The whole presentation there. Let me address one more question Commissioner McIsaac asked earlier. In the years prior to this policy, we're at 3.2, 3.4, 4, 5 on the recreational side. Where was commercial? We prosecuted fisheries at 30%. And we routinely went to 36 and 38. So the balance of that 3% all the way to the 36 or 38 was commercial. Thank you.
Sir, if I could do a...
We got to stop. We got to move through this. I'm sorry, Ross.
I understand. I brought my friend here. Okay. If you issue flexibility and...
Tell your staff to go address the public, okay? It's Groundhog Day all over again. We've done this before. We need something we can stick with, and let's stick with it and see what happens. We've never met. The policy? Okay. Zero for 18 years have we met escapement on Chinook. One out of the last 3 years we met escapement for coho.
All due respect, Ross, we know that.
Two out of those last 6 years. And so we're supposed to hash this out to the staff. That's just Groundhog Day.
30 seconds, and you just entertain that. This is your recreational priority spelled out in your policy in black and white. It just says give us a full season on Chinook. A full season is 6 weeks of Chinook fishing. That's your peak of Chinook timing. That's when they're there, that's when you want to fish. It says specifically no nets in 2T or 2U before September 16th. And it says
for the remainder of the bay, no nets until after Labor Day.
So it's there.
There may be some questions of you by the commission once we get through the panel scenario. Thank you all.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That looked like a carved coconut. Is that what that is?
What is that? This is actually a monkey that my wife, the artist, turned into a
bear. Oh. Okay, Lance Gray, Greg McMillan, and Bob Lake, please.
And just a note of courtesy that
there are ears, young ears of the future in this room. So respect of language by the older members of the future, please, and courtesies.
Are we in a break?
No, go ahead. Well, they'll be back. Go ahead and start, please.
Okay. My name is Bob Lake. I'm the president of Willapa Bay Gillnet Association. I'm also the manager for Willapa Regional Fisheries Enhancement. And I'm going to hit you with one question. Everybody's talking about ESA. Well, here's a response from Jeremy Jordan from NOAA. I'm going to kind of change this. It says, hello, Bruce. Remember the mistake I made yesterday?
I made it.
Regarding your question, if a possible new Endangered Species Act, ESA listing, was pending along the Washington coast, specifically in Willapa Bay, I can tell you at this time we, NOAA, have not received nor are currently reviewing a petition for assessing of any species under our jurisdiction in that geographic area now warrants an ESA listing. We are also not self-initiating a review of species under our jurisdiction in this geographic locale. So that being said, why are all we worried about wild fish? The whole genetic stock index of Willapa fish is the same. Whether it's Bear River, Nacelle, Nema, Willapa River, North River, they're all the same genetic stock index. They got the report back, and I don't know if you guys received it or not, but staff had got that back last fall, I believe. By God, let's utilize something. We have something. We can actually raise fish for the orcas and the whole works. If you guys are willing to adjust the policy, and we'll benefit on the inside of the Willapa. And another quick note on the questions you asked about the peaks and the rises of the Chinook run timing. I started fishing in the Willapa Gillnet in 74, and I actually started fishing July 1st at that time. We fished straight through till the almost end of August, 7 days a week. The majority of those fish we caught was dip-in fish from the Columbia River. The only thing that's happened now is they've changed the who's catching them. It's not us, it's the recreational fishers. And also, one thing we got to really be careful with here is if we go to a 14% harvest rate that's proposed, we won't have any Chinook at all to fish coho and chum with, period. We just don't have them. The numbers aren't there. They hit us with such a high mortality rate, it was inflated terribly. Columbia River is only about 20% of what ours is on their impacts on Chinook. And I don't want to get into a whole lot of things, but I want to give Lance and Greg a chance too. But there was another thing. There was something I found. I was not able to print it out this morning. I ran out of printer ink on color blue, of all things, because they're trying to copy that deal. It was blue back and everything. 2015, Willapa Bay Salmon Management Interim Guidance. There was something supposed to have been done. Chum spawner goals were to be re-evaluated by April 1st, 2015. That never happened. So how do we keep getting the same numbers? We need to assess the whole thing. We know already Nacelle will not support a natural spawning Chinook, period. Nema will not either. And Forks Creek is not going to do a whole lot better. I have born and raised on the Willapa system, and I live there now with all the RSI stuff I'm doing and all that. We need to work together and produce more fish, but we need viable fisheries and a commercial fishery. Pacific County is all but dead. Their whole tax base and money revenue base is from commercial fishing, whether it's salmon, crab, and with that, I'll give it to Lance and Greg.
Good morning, Commissioners. Lance Gray. Todd Quicken here, and I've been a member of this committee. I look behind me, I see Francis and Norm, the only two that have been here since as long as I have. I don't know if that makes us, what, stupid or what it is. We've been through a lot of stuff here. When they throw those numbers up on the board, the one thing I want to say is the four-year average prior to this policy for our commercial fishery, $980,000. The 3 years of the policy, $251,000. That's where we've gone to. I know we talk about priority. We talk about all these things that we have to give it all the sport fishery. We got to get rid of the commercial fishery. If that was what the policy was supposed to do, it's working perfectly. I mean, that it's as simple as that. We cannot survive on $251,000. That's all our fleet brought in. We're talking about a $585 renewal of a license. I provided my bill, which the state advised me not to, for my tangle net last year, $8,100, just to buy the net, the web, the lines, the corks. That's not me putting it together for 3 weeks. I get paid for that. $8,100. We talk about the tangle net fishery as, oh, it's an alternative gear. We are no different than anyone else, trust me. If you can make money at it, they will come. If you can catch fish, they will come. 18 fishers the first year, 12 fishers the next year. This year it'll probably be 10. That's what our fleet is. I mean, these are numbers the state can back it up. That's how many people showed up to fish out of 60 to 70 boats that normally fished in that fishery. We talked about alternative gear with the trap. I've done the seine fishery in the Columbia. I did the trap fishery in the Columbia. Very expensive. And what I'm afraid of is we're going to see someone show up that's not in our fishery now, Samish Bay, reef net fisher, that owns one of these things, puts it in. He may catch some fish with it. It may work for him. I'm not saying that he can't make it work. But how does that help our fishery? If we go give the fishery to some guy that lives in Seattle, I know that's what we're all looking at as far as alternative gears. None of us can afford to spend $100,000 to maybe go make a, whatever it is you think you can catch, 400 fish. It doesn't work. The tangle net, when we do fish the tangle net, we're way behind the fish. Because of the policy, and I know like what you were saying about, we gave you this policy, follow it. There's so many things that we did not know when this policy was done. So the tangle net going in, basically after the fish are gone for us, what's left are small fish, dark fish, and they're not worth anything. But that's what we catch with a tangle net. It's a fish that counts as a number, but you don't see it as an 8-pound average fish that instead of paying you $3.50 for, they pay you $1.50 for, because nobody wants to buy an 8-pound Chinook that's brown. That's what's left there. When we talk about this policy, I want to be very, very clear. I sat on the board. Bob sat on the board. My father sat on the board. Andy Mitby sat on the board, which he couldn't be here because he's coaching two basketball games today. Lucky him. Fourth graders. So this policy, I get sick and tired of hearing that the advisors worked so hard on this policy. There's one group that worked on this policy. There is not one thing in this policy we agreed with. There's not one thing in this policy we worked on. We were handed this policy at a meeting in Raymond, and we left. The members of the commercial fishery left that meeting. It's all on tape. Because we realized the second we read this policy, we were done. That is the end of our commercial fishery, and that's where we are. Go to our communities. This economic enhancement that the sport fishery brings, it's not there. If we're not there year-round to keep those businesses going, they're not there when people show up. People don't come from Olympia to buy 40 cents more gas a gallon. They buy it right here, and then they show up. They bring their food from here. They go to Costco. That's reality. They don't buy their poles, their boats, their cars in Pacific County. They buy it here. There's no economic benefit to us.
Greg McMillan, I'm a Willapa Bay advisor. I was not here from the start, but I've been here from, I've tried to convince the fleet. Lance is right. This is not the policy. It was nothing that the commercial guys came up with, because we tried to sell it to our guys. It was very easy. You know, we had a worksheet that we worked on, and it involved splitting the bay in half. And to have a meaningful commercial fishery in the south end of the bay and a sport fishery in the upper end of the bay. That since got thrown out by the designations of the rivers that are there, by, you know, other things that went with that. So in reality, you know, everything that the commercial side worked on this policy, it never happened. And here we, you know, like I said, we tried to convince our people that this was the way to go, and this gets dumped on us. And I just wanted to make it clear that there's not a commercial fisherman in this room, and for me to say this, trust me, is a good thing. But not one commercial fisherman in this room is saying shut a recreational fishery down, that we want all the impacts. Not one. All we're asking for, why don't you run it like every other fishery in the state? Or, excuse me, just say the Columbia. That's where my experience is. Columbia, have a bag limit like that. Why do they have to have a 4 to 6 fish bag limit, whatever it is? You know, why? That's what we don't understand. That's what's affecting our fishery to where we don't get to fish. And nobody here is trying to say shut them down. We want a fishery. There were some other things in this policy that hasn't come today. I mean, every year for the last 3 years, we have come with new information, assumptions, as what's said on the screen. The assumption was we had a genetically diverse or different wild fish. Well, it's not. There hasn't been any habitat study. That was supposed to happen. We don't even know what the escapement's supposed to be. We have no idea. We have numbers that are thrown out there. But has there been a study? Has there been any effort? No, there hasn't been anything. So, I mean, you talk about the tangle nets. Why are we at a 33% mortality rate on our tangle net when you're at 14% in the Columbia River that spent millions of dollars studying it? It makes no sense. That curtails our fishery, the IFSP stuff. I mean, you guys act like we're not trying. You are looking at two of the people that I guarantee have had the most observers on their boats. And just like I've told everybody, I fish in Alaska. We're successful. I bring my money back here. And I don't care if I get one day, I'm going to fish because they're going to see me out there. Because they have taken a good fishery away. Look at 2014. You don't have to go far back. Everybody had a great fishery. The commercial fishery did. The sport fishery did. Everybody enjoyed a good fishery. But no, that wasn't good enough. We have to cut production. We have to take from one sector. I mean, it's hard not to let your emotion get in this. But this has decimated my business. Decimated it. And a lot of other businesses. Just like Lance said, you had 12 people participate in a fishery that has 151 licenses. How is that right? I mean, it's not right. Look at the genetics. Look at what you're protecting. What are we protecting? That's this whole policy is, what are we conserving? We're conserving a hatchery fish that just happens to have a spawn. And I live on the Nacelle River, and I'll invite every one of you guys to sit in my backyard and watch the fish swim by and watch. I've got 30 to 40 pairs that are spawning behind my house every day. And I guarantee you can look through there and you can find a natural fish spawning with a hatchery fish. And until you stop that, I don't know how we're going to have a genetic...
One last thing for me.
We got two minutes, guys.
Okay.
I'll give you three.
Go ahead, Bob, if you want to go.
Just
take a minute.
I got one suggestion. Also, maintain our harvest rate at 20% and relook at the impacts that we've been hit with as far as mortalities, which is critical. And the other thing is we want to make sure Nacelle is changed from contributing to a supplemental hatchery and absolutely maximize the production for Chinook out of Nacelle. They've got the money to do it, and the whole works. The legislature's behind it, and the whole works. So, Lance?
Yeah, I think that when you look at, and I've hit on this before with you guys, and I don't know if it comes to light, when we talk about this payback of, the policy says we're going to pay it back. The problem I have, and I've asked Chad can't explain it, he'd probably stand up back there and shake his head and go, I can't explain this to you. When we fish, whether it be commercial or recreational, their encounter rate is way higher than our actual return rate. But when we base our 20%, It's based on our return, what we got back. So it either tells you that we're not able to count all the fish because we don't have the money, which is probably the truth. We're not able to assess what we actually have. We probably have a much lower rate than 20%, but we don't have the money to go look at it. So that's what I think. And then when you look at the PHAS and all these NAS, all these numbers and things they throw out, you've got to realize that when a nacelle, you're going, oh, the nacelle looks good, it's coming down. There goes the production. Guess what's going to happen? That number that, oh, we finally got one down to where we want it. Boom. It's going to jump back up to 75 or 80%. They did a great job in trying to fix a couple of things we had there. God knows nacelle hatchery needs some money put into it. But you're dealing with low numbers. When those numbers come back off the 2.5 million returns, that number is going to shoot up once again, and it's going to be 4 or 5 years, 3 or 4 years from now. And we're going to be like, oh, man, we've been doing this policy 7, 8 years. We should be seeing some success. It's going to just go way out of whack again. But we have to change, and I know you don't want to change things in the policy, but if we don't, our fishery's gone, and really the only thing you can do is stop raising fish. That's all I have to say. Any questions?
It could be easy to change in its priority.
We'll do the
questions. Get rid of their priorities.
I'd love any questions. If you have questions, we're better to answer questions.
What we can do is if the commissioners have questions of any of the participants in the panels after we're done, they can ask you them, if that's okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Do you have something you want to say? Okay, it is Jesse Helsley and Andy Appleby. Andy, we haven't seen you in years. Nice to see you again. Jess, nice to meet you. I don't know how you guys want to start, but I know there was a couple questions that I forwarded to you that were generated, one of each of you for. We've never had, in my experience, a conservation-based panel involved in this discussion on any of the fisheries, and so I look forward to your comments and ideas. So however you want to fit those two questions in respectively around your other comments would be appreciated.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Commissioner. I'm delighted to be here. I'm going to try to help you out and get my stopwatch going here. This is a pretty risky business, asking me to talk for only 10 minutes on this, because as those of you that have heard me before, I can get very passionate about this topic.
Andy, if I may, why don't you just give a brief of your experience real quickly so people that don't know you
absolutely
can know you.
My name is Andy Appleby. I'm currently the co-chair of the Hatchery Scientific Review Group. In the name of full disclosure, I spent 32 years with the agency, all of that time as a hatchery biologist, and I've been involved with the HSRG since 2003. I've been to a number of Willapaw Bay meetings myself. You hear the passion, and I heard a lot, actually, that I agreed with from everybody that spoke. So hopefully this will go well. I want to preface my comments by starting with the founding legislation. This is not intended to be a lecture to the commission, but I always think that it helps set the context for the discussions that we often have about managing natural resources. Just a couple of key points I've highlighted in red here. First of all, fish, wildlife, and shellfish are the property of the state. They belong to all the citizens of the state. That's obvious. The commission, the director, the agency, your goal is to preserve, protect, perpetuate. And this legislation gives you the authority to manage. All right, that's great. Citizens own this. They want somebody to manage it for them. You have that job. But they're a little more specific than that. The direction is that you shall conserve the resource that you manage. And most important here, and one of my favorite lines in this, is you're going to do that in a manner that does not impair the resource. Okay, that is your standard for how you're doing. Secondarily, consistent with this idea. They definitely wanted you to maintain orderly commercial recreational fisheries. They recognize the benefit this resource provides. But it's the secondary challenge in your founding legislation. Your first job is to conserve the resource. Finally, and this is, I haven't quoted the entire RCW here, but I think this is particularly important for to remind the audience what you folks have a particular responsibility to, and that is you can authorize the taking of fish in terms of the abundance and time and place, but only if, in your judgment, that would not impair the resource. Okay? So, outcomes. Heard a lot of talk about listing. I've always felt that an ESA listing is really more a legal determination of the status of a population, and frankly, I think a very low bar. Because if you, in other words, if you feel comfortable with your management strategy because it's not listed, I think that your founding legislation describes a much higher standard of care. Avoiding listing, while certainly is a worthy cause, that's nowhere close to what your founding legislation directs you to do. What are the issues? Some of them. Chinook populations in Willapa Bay are no longer distinct, but we've heard that several times. Absolutely true. Most natural spawning fish are first or second generation hatchery fish. Absolutely true. And finally, on the benefit side, you've got reduced benefits from all fisheries because of the potential harvest that goes unharvested every year because the excess fish above broodstock at the hatchery and the excess fish that are on the spawning grounds over and above your hatchery fishery reform policy dictates. The good news, there's been a lot of effort in this regard, not just in Willapa, but all over the state. Wild, we can all go back to 1997 with the wild salmonid policy. You adopted the hatchery fishery reform policy in 2009. The draft Willapa Bay management plan came out in 2010, which, by the way, was pleased to see a copy of your founding legislation on the front page of that document. Remind the folks that were going to read that document, what is it you're trying to accomplish? Your Willapa Bay policy in 2015, and the one thing that has never gone unnoticed to me, sole legal authority to manage resources in Willapa Bay. There's no UV Oregon, there's no UV Washington, there's no U.S. Canada issues that you have to relate to. So solving the hatchery age. Hatchery reform does provide the means and methods to allow for distinct natural populations to develop and become productive through process of local adaptation. Even if their origins are different from historical populations, and by the way, in areas of that are listed as ESA that find themselves in this same predicament, Lower Columbia comes to mind, a number of places in Puget Sound come to mind, that doesn't give you a pass on ESA. If you don't have distinct populations there, then you're expected to allow them to develop. And this is what you're trying to do in Willapa Bay. As Chad pointed out quite accurately, this is done by managing the gene flow. What past hatchery practices have actually pushed those populations to end up exactly as we see them now. Moving eggs from one hatchery to another and releasing those has mixed those at one time distinct genetic populations up so that they're all the same. And I won't fault the decisions at the time to do that. I was at the nacelle, at that dedication for the nacelle hatchery in 1981. you operate with the best information you have at the time, we all hope, right? And the point of my talk is that we now have better information and better techniques, and so we should apply those. You heard also about PNI and PHAS, the proportion of natural influence is PNI. That's how you measure the gene flow for integrated programs, those programs at Forks Creek and Nacelle. And PHAS is really the metric you use to judge how well you're running segregated programs, i.e. NEMA might be considered one of those. Solving the harvest age. Selective fishing provides the means for those naturally produced fish to escape in sufficient numbers and over generations. For local adaptation to work, it has to be passed on from adult to juvenile. That means the parents and the grandparents have to be natural origin fish as well. Only when you do that do you allow a local adaptation to work and the productivity of those fish to increase. That's really the key to hatchery reform, is getting naturally spawning fish, while they may be very closely related to hatchery fish in the beginning, over time, they will adapt to their environment. As bad as the habitat may be in any point in time, they'll get better at reproducing in that environment. Currently, and I'll do me a favor, please, and this concept applies to your thinking on the Columbia River policy. This concept applies to your thinking on increasing salmon populations to feed orcas. Your staff does a very good job of keeping hatchery data and spawning ground data up to date. It's easily accessible. Look at the current surplus of hatchery and Chinook by hatchery that exist over the last, let's say, 3 or 4 year average, in excess of broodstock. Add to that the excess hatchery fish that are on the spawning grounds over and above your 2009 policy. Those fish should have been harvested. They were reared to be harvested. And I can tell you, a brief look at Willapaw for the most recent 3 or 4 years showed those numbers add up to an amount almost equal to what was actually caught. Now, why the orcas didn't eat those fish, I don't know. You need to talk to somebody that knows something about orcas to see what's the right group of fish if you're going to put more fish out there for orcas. They obviously need to come from a specific place, because we had 20,000 excess Chinook here last year in Deschutes that fishermen didn't catch and orcas didn't eat. We had 35,000 excess Chinook at George Adams Hatchery on Hood Canal that nobody took. We had something around 20,000 excess Chinook last year at Klamath Falls on the Columbia River. So my point here is that before you get ready to produce more hatchery fish, either craft fisheries that will allow you to access those surpluses that already will occur. And I got to say one thing about the recreational commercial. I know folks in the audience have heard me say this before. Those fisheries are incredibly linked. A successful recreational fishery in this day and age will need to depend on a viable commercial fishery. Quoting those surplus numbers that I gave you just before, there, especially with coho, because weirs don't typically work on coho, there is no way other than reducing hatchery production to meet your hatchery reform policy standards if you don't have a way of absorbing most of those excess hatchery fish.
6 minutes left.
And here's my summary. Salmon populations are in their current conditions in large part due to past management practices of the three H's. It's not rocket science. If you, knowing what we know now, looking with hindsight, seeing what we did, guess what? we'd predict they look exactly like they currently look. Better understanding of harvest, hatcheries, and habitat improvements. I think we owe it to the resource, future citizens of Washington State, to apply that understanding in a manner consistent with your founding legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Smith, commissioners, and department staff. We're grateful for the opportunity to speak before you today. As mentioned, this may be one of the first times a conservation panel has been brought into the discussion. We appreciate that very much. My name is Jessica Helsley. I'm the Executive Director of the Coast Salmon Partnership. We are one of seven regional salmon recovery organizations in the state. Our organization works from Cape Flattery in the north to Cape Disappointment in the south and includes all watersheds that drain directly into the Pacific. We work to keep our salmon runs, our livelihoods, and the way of life that depends on them healthy by identifying the barriers to healthy salmon runs and developing science-based solutions to address them. The Washington coast represents the last best chance for us to get salmon recovery right. Of the state's listed salmon populations, 50% call our coastal rivers home. We have an opportunity to rethink our management approach, as it is far easier and much less expensive to protect and restore populations before they are listed than it is to do so after the fact. Today I'm going to discuss some of our habitat restoration efforts in Willapa Bay. I'm going to try to move as quickly as I can to get through this information, but it is very valuable information. First, we commend the Commission, the Department, and all stakeholders in their recognition of the importance of these coastal runs, the recognition of worrisome declines, and efforts made by all to reverse those trends. While it is human nature to focus on our differences and challenges, we prefer to start our discussion by acknowledging that development of the policy, early efforts to explore alternative gear techniques, and conversion to tangle nets by some of the very stakeholders in this room, those are all steps in the right direction, and everyone should be commended for that fact. There has been significant investment and effort put into habitat restoration in the Willapa Bay watershed over the past 19 years. Just under $19 million has been spent on efforts to improve both habitat quantity and quality. In the Willapa Bay watershed, we have restored over 4,500 riparian acres, installed nearly 900 large woody debris structures, and removed over 50 fish passage barriers, helping salmon to return to nearly 100 miles and 621 acres of habitat that they'd been locked out of for decades. This work not only benefits our salmon, it also benefits our communities. Research shows that every $1 million spent on restoration results in an average of 16.7 jobs. Every $1 million spent on restoration also generates an estimated $2.2 to $2.5 million in total economic activity, and 80% of that restoration money stays in the county where the project occurred. This is significant to coastal communities out on the coast that continue to experience some of the highest unemployment rates in the state. By no means are our efforts complete. There is still a tremendous need for habitat restoration. However, compared to other areas in the state, our habitat is more pristine and more intact than elsewhere, meaning that our investment has the potential to provide significant returns on the future. However, our habitat restoration and protection efforts are all for naught if we do not leverage our investment in reclaimed habitat by allowing enough natural origin spawners to seed the newly reclaimed habitat unadulterated. There are worrisome trends in the policy's implementation. Despite the primary conservation objective of the policy, we continue to lack the ability for adequate in-season management due to lack of funding. We're unable to meet the policy's escapement goals and unable to adequately mop up hatchery fish without hammering our natural origin stocks. Thus, we're subsequently unable to meet our PHAS and P&I targets. We should be alarmed by this inability to effectively implement the policy, and I hope that we can all work collaboratively to identify the steps necessary for proper implementation. Current implementation of the policy is encouraging harvest to distinction. We need to work outside of our silos and collaborate across all arenas impacting fisheries. Most importantly, we need to change our mindset. As it was referred to yesterday, the conservation objective is not a burden. It is not something to be bore by all stakeholders or one or another. Rather, it is our obligation as stewards of this incredible resource. We need to manage the resource for our children's grandchildren. Our willingness to evolve our practices and adapt to the changing environment is the best tool we have if we want to successfully manage the species to a future of sustainable harvest. A lot of people ask why we do the work that we do. Habitat restoration is, in essence, we're climbing an uphill battle of 1,000 years of history. It's not an easy task. I come from Idaho, where I had an opportunity to work with a tribe over there in my graduate research, and one of their elders told me that salmon really saved humans, that a monster had come and eaten up all of the species of the earth, and the last few remaining animals, badger and coyote was this trickster creator, right? And so they came up with a plan to slay the monster, and coyote had an obsidian sword that was made for him. He tucked it up underneath his chest, and he taunted the monster and said, "I bet you can't eat me. I bet you can't swallow me in one bite." The monster swallowed Coyote whole, and once Coyote was inside, he started cutting away at the monster piece by piece. And for every piece of the monster's flesh that hit the ground, the deer returned, and the elk returned, and the badgers returned. And now Coyote is standing there with nothing but the blood from the heart of the monster. And all of the animals say, "Well, Coyote, what about the people? You haven't brought the people back." And he said quizzically, "Do you really want to do that? They rely on us to feed them and to clothe them. They're not as smart as the rest of us. Should we bring them back?" And salmon was the only species to make his way through the crowd. And he raised his fin and he says, "I will sacrifice my flesh and my blood to bring back the people." So now I take it upon all of you, us in the Coast Salmon Partnership, have our sleeves rolled up. We're out there working to restore degraded stretches of rivers and creeks, to assist in the exploration of alternative gear technologies, such as the work that we're helping to facilitate in the Lower Columbia River, and to speak up for the salmon in policy discussions like this. We ask that you all roll your sleeves up with us. We ask that we all work together, the commercial fishermen, the sports fishermen. We understand these conversations have been had in the past. Somehow we're still at the same point, and we need to have them again. So we just encourage everyone to let's work together to try to solve this problem. We can get a lot further working together than we can trying to work against each other. So thank you very much. Happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much. I'm a big supporter of RFEGs, and I think that we need to do more to support you guys. I was on the board of Nooksack, so I know that. Thank you, too, for your wise counsel at the end there. We do have, going into the public input for this item, a handful of people were running behind time. After the public input, I will ask the commissioners to restrict themselves to one question per person, because we do have to follow up with another two and a half hour important session. So think about the question if you wish to ask after we're done this. So on the public input, two, I'll call you up and you all know this, Kurt Kramer and Norm Reinhart, please. Yeah, but then give it to staff. Don't leave it here.
Morning once again. Glad you could have me again. I've watched this proceeding this morning with great interest. I'm a long-term in Willapa Bay Recreational Fisheries and have joined many hours down there. It's a very complex issue. It's a thorny problem. You guys have a tiger by the tail, and you're going to have to be really careful that it doesn't eat you. When you manage for wild...
We have an obsidian sword in us.
Exactly. That's what you need. Wild fish management means you have to just find a way of differentiating, exploiting hatchery and wild fish. That's always the trick, always will be the trick. That's what you have to wrestle with. The harsh reality is different kind of gears have different kinds of impacts in that process. And your trick is going to be to try to distill that information with as little politics as possible. For example, today I heard in the testimony, the Willapa Bay plan calls for a 35% gillnet release mortality. I heard on the Columbia it was 14%. The 10-year Chinook plan you just looked at, the co-managers agreed it's 100%. I submit the real number is probably something in that range, but the number used in management is driven by politics. And your job, one of your jobs, is going to be to shift through that and get the best values available. And that depends on the recreational fisheries and all of those. And somehow you're going to have to shift through all that. You know, and looking at this, I think your job in the next 2 years is going to get worse instead of better. You've decreased, by your policy, the hatchery fishery released in Willapa Bay by eightfold. That's where the recreational fishery fishes. That's where the infrastructure is to support the recreational fishery. You know, at the same time, you increase the hatchery releases in the Nacelle by threefold. That's where the commercial guys want to fish. The rec guys aren't going to be able to get there in any meaningful number to catch the fish. The commercial guys aren't going to be able to catch all those fish because they're constrained by impacts. I think in some ways your policies may have made your life much more complex. I would counsel you folks, the agency policy folks, the agency staff, the commission, to try to look at this thing in as proactive a fashion as you can. Look forward, not next year, not 3 weeks from now, not this summer, but 5 years, 10 years down the road. Where are we going? Develop a roadmap to get there and act accordingly. Put the fish first and then the user second. And you'll be somewhere in the ballpark. Yeah. And you have to, you know, then there's huge questions with what the viability of a bona fide Chinook program is in Willapa Bay. And that's, you know, I don't have any information on that, but that's an issue you're going to have to wrestle with. I wish you luck. I wish you wisdom. And I hope you fall on my side of the table at least partially. Thank you.
Hi, my name's Norm Reinhart. I'm the president of the Kitsap Pogie Club. I've been a member of the Willapa Bay Advisory Group since approximately 2005. Ironically, I was not invited to be on a panel because none of them want to own me. Perhaps I'll be providing a somewhat different perspective. We have the most aggressive conservation policy in the state in Willapa Bay. I'm here for one reason. I want to see a 2T recreational Chinook fishery maintained in that North Bay. That's what I got involved for. What has transpired in the 10-plus years that I've been involved has become extremely complex. When we started, Andy back there came to us and talked to us about the all-age policy. And one aspect of that all-age policy is that in order to have, he's already stated it, to have robust recreational fisheries, We need to have a commercial aspect of harvest in order to contain those hatchery fish on the spawning beds. He's a scientist. He explained it beautifully. So what's the consequences if we can't? Well, the consequences is that the public society has to come up with the funding to adequately fund properly maintained and managed hatcheries or hatchery practices that will, in fact, remove or drive the genetics to the wild population side. Until that happens, we need to have a commercial fishery, or, and here's the hook. The hook is, Andy told us this a long time ago, you don't make them. What do I mean? I mean, we don't fund the hatcheries. I mean that we reduce hatchery production to levels that may result in the conservation objectives of this policy, but it most certainly won't. It won't do anything for either the recreational or the commercial fleet, nor the communities that depend on a well-managed natural resource harvest management practices. So, If we want to close the hatcheries, if we want to turn Willapa Bay into a wild fish conservancy 100-year experiment, we will continue on this adversarial path. I don't propose to do that. I think that we should find a way to be able to work through it so that we can have meaningful opportunities for all aspects of the communities involved. And it falls, unfortunately,
right here on your shoulders. And that is a tough nut. Thank you for all of your work.
My name is Dale Beasley. I am a 45-year commercial fisherman, fortunately retired. I don't have to deal with this anymore, but I do because I'm president of the Coalition of Coastal Fisheries. And a year ago, my crab fleet told me I should start paying attention to salmon, which I haven't done. I used to fish salmon, but not since 1979, so it's been a while. And Willapa is unique in the nation, or in this state, where the management objectives aren't as complex as a lot of portions of this that have a lot of treaties that have to be abided by and met. Willapa doesn't have that. And one of the things that you have an option to do with your policy is to manage salmon for abundance with no fishermen left behind in this watershed that you don't have in other areas. And what I would like to impress upon you today is that I'm sincerely worried about the next generation of commercial fishermen not even being here. Salmon has always played an integral part in the building blocks of that fleet, whether it be troll salmon or gillnet or whatever it is. It's really an important part of the next generation. And if you need to start taking a larger look at your commercial fleet, it's not just about in the Willapa or in the Columbia or in Puget Sound. All of those pieces are important to our next generation. It's very, very expensive to get into fishing today. I know. And if you don't start taking a broader look to preserve that industry, it's going to be gone. And if you look at the decline of salmon on the coast and other places available for harvest, you can look at the demographics going downhill, especially in the coastal counties. You can't ignore the impacts on people. You know, salmon are important, and your first charge is conservation. And your other charge has to look broader and look at the people. You just look at the demographics in the coastal counties, Wakayak and Pacific, Grays. They've got the highest unemployment rate in the state. That never used to be. As salmon's declined, those unemployment rates have gone down. Your poverty rates have gone up. Your health outcomes have turned. Your lifespans have shortened. You've got lower median family incomes here than you used to have. You've got the highest suicide rates in the state in these counties right here on the coast. You've got to start looking at them. They're connected to salmon. I could go on. I've got some written. I will leave for you. And it's important to look more broadly than you are. The next generation of fishermen needs a little help, and salmon is where it needs to happen. If you keep going down the road, they will fail, and it will be because of policies that have neglected those people's needs.
Good afternoon. My name is Bob Lake. I am the president of Willapa Bay Gillnet Association and also the manager for Willapa Regional Fisheries Enhancement. And there's a couple other things I would like to bring your attention to. And I really appreciated what Andy Appleby and Jess had to present to you guys, because I thought it gives you a better concept of what's going on there. And one of the things I'd like to bring out is the surplus on the three hatcheries last year for Chinook was 4,518. That was the surplus fish that was over and above the what was needed for egg takes at the hatcheries, and also 694 more pond morts. But then also, and then the surplus on coho was 12,829. So if you recall what we spoke of earlier and our mortalities and our how they're figured and our harvest rate, if you consider that, we could have taken a lot of those surplus fish by, you know, by utilizing the fishery better. And another thing I'd like to bring out is The Chum situation, if you look at what happened and ask staff to probably put your graph together, from 1990, when they stopped the hatchery production of chum in Willapa Bay, all of our natural stocks have been in steady decline. It's very critical to look at that. Chum are a forage fish for both Chinook and Coho when they hit the bay. And the other plus thing for that for chum production, chum is the only fish that eats the ghost shrimp and sand shrimp larvae to control that. So the whole ecosystem really needs to be addressed here, and chum is the start of it. So with that, I'll know you guys are busy and short for time. Thank you very much.
Morning. My name's Dave Hamilton. I see some new faces, so my usual disclaimer is I'm the world's worst public speaker. So, you know, it just goes without saying. I'll get out of here quickly if I can. In the Willapa policy, there are only three items. There's a lot of stuff out there flying around, details, and because I work with hatcheries, if you'd ever watch me and Andy argue about it, you can go all over the place, okay? But the Willapa policy is really two policies in one, okay? It's like a Jekyll and Hyde. The first 4 years, the wreck will have the upper hand as far as harvest, okay, and Chinook priority, okay. But after 4 years, that does a 180 reversal, okay? And the production for Chinook goes to the southern part of the bay. What that means is this. After 2020, probably, because three-year-olds come back in 2020, when that happens, they will have zero data on harvest as far as TNU, because what they have now is not any good, won't apply because of different release. So that means nobody knows what happens in 2020, because the fish come down the coast and they come in Willapa. Because the vast majority no longer head up the Willapa River, they are going south down the sound, and nobody knows where they're going to make that left-hand turn, how far down. If it's way down, nobody knows, okay? So that is the Jekyll and Hyde. You're asked to discuss the training wheel time. The first 4 years where the policy was supposed to bring conservation to the forefront and force the users, rec and commercial, to be selective. Two real things laid out there could blow it apart. One, if the commercials refuse to go selective, and they have. A few have, but it's not been an effort. And two, if the runs crashed. You guys are really fortunate. You got the perfect storm. They both happened, and you're not out of the training wheel stage. So, guys, commissioners, you have a job to do, but here's the thing. This is the training wheel stage. This is where it's supposed to be most difficult as we learn to do this, okay? And because it's hard for the agency to figure out, or hard for the commercials to do that, or hard for the rec not to use barbless, it doesn't matter. That's not the purpose of the policy. The policy is to drive the natural spawners up. And we can take everything we can, sport or commercial, but that line needs to be headed up. It's going to do this on the graph, but it's got to head up. Okay, that is the purpose of it. Now, for staff, this is the third item, to come in and say they are confused. You said about language. There's a term in the military. Let's just say it's a load of something, because they were there. Ron Warren, Jim Scott, I can tell you right where the discussion happened in that high school, and it was loud and raucous, and three of the four people participating across the table are there. The agency knows all the potential impacts. You simply got the worst one you could dream of with the crashing stock and the commercials not cooperating. But there cannot be any confusion from the agency staff. Okay. Good day.
Hi, excuse me. I'm Lisa Olson. I'm Pacific County Commissioner. So I'm here in that capacity, and also just as a private citizen who has grown up on the Willapa. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. The basic economics of Pacific County are poor. We are struggling financially as a county. We have some of the highest taxes, property taxes in the state. We also have the second highest unemployment rate in the state from when I last looked. And so the last thing we need is more unemployment. these jobs that we're talking about used to support families on a yearly basis. They were that's what they did, and then they went off and did other things in the off season. Now it's a side job because they can't. Most of them can't support themselves just with fishing. And that's crab, that's salmon, that's, you know, almost anything. There's still a few people that can do it, but not very many. The sportsmen and the commercial fishermen have one thing in common. The fish are in their blood. It's part of who they are. It's part of their being. It's part of who we are in Pacific County. We're a natural resources county. We don't have any industry. We have, Weyerhaeuser has a mill, but that's also based in natural resources. That's timber, obviously. We have timber, we have salmon, we have oysters, we have cranberries. That's who we are. You know, we don't have Walmarts and Costcos and a lot of other stuff. That's just who we are. And we would like to stay that way, and we would like to not become someone's playground. We want to invite people in to experience our community, but be able to live there and thrive there on our own as well. We love it when people come in and enjoy what we have to offer. The working man, you know, we talk about declining species. The working man is a declining species. You look at the nation, farmers and natural people on every level are struggling. And I don't think that's a necessity. I think it's something that if we all work together maybe change the rules, I don't know, that we have to go by. If we all work together, I think everybody can coexist. We all need the farmers and the fishermen and the plumbers and the electricians. We need all these people. So I don't want to see them go extinct either. And just finally, the Willapa Bay is the most pristine estuary on the West Coast, if not in the nation. And there's a reason for that. It's been managed well, and there's people that have lived and worked on this bay, in these estuaries, on the Columbia, on the Willapa, the Nacelle, the Neva, all over, for decades. And that level of experience, the scope and breadth of their knowledge, and what they see on a daily basis is invaluable. And I would ask, I heard somebody mention, you know, not that anybody wants to go to another meeting, but, you know, I would really like to see these folks and their experience and knowledge on the ground be included with the science that comes from the educated people, because I think it's invaluable, and I think it's a tragedy that if it's not being considered. And just finally, this is probably kind of dumb, but from a layman's point of view, is anyone looking beyond the rules to observe the reality of the food chain? I know Dale or Bob touched on it. There's a lot of different factors over the decades that have changed what's eating what, and you know, and then there's the 800-pound gorilla in the room that nobody has talked about, which is the seal. And I understand that may not be in your purview, but everything I'm finding out, unfortunately, comes down to politics. And if you guys have any sway on the national level, I don't know if anybody's been on the Oregon side of the Columbia River at the Safeway getting gas, but all you hear is bark, 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 bark. There are, and it gets worse as you go down the coast. You stand out there and it's like, what the hell is that? And it seals, and there are so many of them that it echoes up off the water. And not that I don't like seals, I think they're adorable, but it's like everything else, it has to be managed. They have to be a part of the resource management. Thank you very much.
Grayland, so I'm hoping to support your economy a bit. I enjoy it down there.
And we welcome you. Thank you.
And if your traveling partner wants any more goodies,
you are so sweet. Thank you.
Have her come back here and she can pick her up.
Did she tell you I don't feed her?
No, I didn't want to get in trouble for giving her bad stuff.
No,
pretty healthy.
No, you gave her pretty good stuff. You gave her better stuff than I do.
Okay. Well, come back here and graze before you go home. Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Greg, you're the last of this.
You guys might wonder why an old guy from the Callis is here. Well, I caught my first blueback salmon on the Nema River. I caught my first steelhead on the Willapa, and I caught my first coho on the Willapa. And I also had my wife catch her first Chinook on Willapa Bay. So Willapa Bay is dear, dear to my heart. I have relatives that worked in the commercial fishing industry and the oyster industry down there, and I also got the Hello Bruce letter, too. Regarding your question, if possible, the new Endangered Species Act listing pending along the Washington coast, specifically in Willapa Bay, I can tell you at this time, NOAA, National Marine Fisheries Services, has not received nor currently reviewing any petition to assess if any species under our jurisdiction in that geographical area now warrants ESA listing. We also are not self-initiating a review of species under this jurisdiction and graphic. I talked to Jeremy Jordan on Thursday, and he's telling me this is the same as it was in 16. It is the same today. Jeremy's telling me that. So it's the same today. The thing I don't like about this policy is the hatchery production. Okay. We don't have a Cowlitz River, early Chambers Creek fish, and Willapa Bay. What I do like about this policy is being able to fish in the T, the wrecks being able to fish in the 2T, 2U, I think it is. I call it in front of Tokelin. Okay. And I agree with that policy. But this, like I said, these are not Chamber Creek, Puget Sound Chambers Creek stock. These are Willapa Bay stock. Doesn't matter which hatchery. We should be pumping out hatchery fish, because we have to remember too that I testified, and Puget Sound anglers testified, CCA testified, the trollers testified, all on House Bill 2417 about 10 million more Chinook for orca whales, okay? We all testified in favor of production, and a lot of the, and some of the production was on Willapa Bay, okay? I hope that CCA remembers that. But I want to read you this, and this is bigotry calls for violence following a protest of tribal treaty fishing, okay? This was back in 2016. While fishery management in Washington State were undoing a policy, see changes in the following, in the wake of the Department of Fish and Wildlife May closure of a salmon fishery in several lakes and lowland reaches of the Puget Sound Rivers, a small federally approved ceremonial sustainable fishery for treaty tribes, recreation individual groups, organization protested. In the process, one group, Coastal Conservation, distorted the facts about tribal fishing and flirted with the equal rights language and organized an anti-Indian movement, online response with press coverage and conflict, protests and less intolerance and bigotry directed at tribes ranging from anti-Indian symmetry to avoid tribal transformation of treaty obligations. Okay. What I'm saying is I hear this same kind of bigotry named at the commercial gill netters. And it's terrible. We've got to work with these guys. We've got to have a valuable sport fishing. We've got to have a valuable commercial. We've got to stop this. Like I said yesterday, you guys know how I feel. Thank you.
We have a very full agenda coming up. So we've been provided with a great deal of information, and we appreciate the input from all of you sincerely. We're going to take all of that and digest it and process it, and then provide on our next conference call some direction to the department on what we were asked to do. But right now, given the time, and also just we're kind of bubbling over with knowledge here. So we need some time to think about this. So we're going to hold our questions on this. We'll pick this up at our next conference call and get back to our hardworking, dedicated staff. Sorry, Norm, I got to move ahead. So we will do that. The next conference call is coming up in a couple weeks. So with that, again, thank you for the panels. We will